Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran strongly condemns the terrorist attack in the Turkish city of Istanbul, reaffirming its unwavering support for the government and people of Turkey. Saudi Arabia detains a Yemeni American citizen while performing the Hajj pilgrimage over remarks critical of the monarchy. Also ahead, tens of thousands take to the streets in Mexico to protest President Obrador's plan to overhaul the country's electoral commission. Our top story, Iran strongly condemns the attack in the Turkish city of Istanbul, which left at least 6 people dead and more than 80 others wounded. The foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Tehran censures any act of terrorism that undermines the security of Turkey. He added that the Islamic Republic stands by the Turkish government and people. The blast occurred on the busy Istiklal Street in Taksim area, which is popular with locals and tourists. Turkish authorities say a woman carried out the attack. There's been no claim of responsibility yet. Istanbul and other Turkish cities have in the past been targeted by Kurdish separatists, Daesh terrorists and other groups. Tehran has reacted to the French President Emmanuel Macron's meeting with so-called anti-Iran campaigners. During our news review program, we discussed France's support for destabilizing acts against the Islamic Republic.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The French President Emmanuel Macron's recent meeting with anti-Iran activists is drawing a strong reaction from Tehran. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the meeting was a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. He dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said that it is surprising that the president of a country which advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside and in Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Macron on Friday met with 4 notorious anti-Iran women activists, among them Masih Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. Masoud Shajari from the Islamic Human Rights Commission joins us from London. We also have Said Zafar Mehdi, who is a journalist, joining us here in the capital, Tehran. Welcome to you both. Masoud Shajari, first I'll start with you. It's quite interesting to have this meeting with these anti-Iran activists. I'm not too sure what to name them, but we're going to name them that. But the first question that comes about is, how does a meeting like that actually take place? Because behind the scenes, obviously, something was in the works in order to have a presence of another country, in this case France, meet with them. What do you think about this meeting?
Well, the fact of the matter is that these individuals, in particular Masih, is known for promoting violence or indeed working with the terrorist groups like MKO and others to undermine and create destabilize and securitize the state of Iran. And it around the world would allow this sort of insecurity to be systematically promoted and implemented in their country. And the fact of the matter is, it's not just standing for the concept of freedom or freedom of expression or women's rights. It really goes far. France is not just a sort of bystander activities of destabilizing Iran, to turn Iran to another Libya and Syria, it actually is actively involved. And by promoting these individuals and meeting them, it actually proves that. And then on the other side, what is really important is France talking about freedom for women. You know, come on, this is the country that sort of banned hijab. This is a country that at the same time asking people to wear face masks is actually make it unlawful for women to actually have a niqab. And they are not able to go to be educated. They can't go to university. They can't go to schools. They can't go to governmental buildings for sort of having hijab or niqab. And they have got the audacity to talk about freedom for women. I mean, come on, this is outrageous. You know, they should be ashamed of themselves to actually come out with this sort of slogans and trying to actually use these sort of principles for trying to create disharmony and dissecurity in Iran, and doing this so publicly and so openly and so so much based on double standards and hypocrisy.
Well, Sayed Zafar-Mahdi, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the character and the personality that the French president seems to have been so keen to entertain and to receive by the name of Masih Ali Najad, because her background is not one that really is something to be, in some sense, proud of when you take a look at the associations that she has. And in particular, if you can expand on how she's being somewhat supported by either this administration or the former administration, from the likes of the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for example, and other U.S. officials, even people that perhaps is being speculated that she's being thwarted into the scene by providing her with finances in order for her to promote her anti-Iran agenda.
First of all, thank you for having me. Well, be it French presidents meeting with this notorious self-proclaimed rights activist, or his shameful, ridiculous remarks that he made after meeting them, or even that of the German chancellor, it clearly amounts to brazen interference in Iran's internal affairs. Well, as you can see, these Western officials, which includes Macron and other Western officials, have been hell-bent on stoking sedition, on instigating rioters, on fanning the flames of unrest in Iran and anarchy, civil war in Iran in recent weeks. The fact that Macron met this delegation of self-proclaimed human rights activists makes it even more preposterous. You know, as the foreign ministry spokesman said earlier today, and you mentioned it, these women have been primarily responsible for fanning violence and hatred in Iran in recent weeks by spreading misinformation and propaganda on social media, on other media. Like, take the case of Masih Ali Najad, you know, one of the women who met Macron. She has been, you know, on the payroll of CIA and US State Department for years now, and it's very clear to everybody. And her task is very clear-cut, you know, cut out, you know, to push the regime change agenda of the Western powers in Iran through propaganda, through misinformation, and she gets paid for that. And she has, in recent weeks, you know, sort of bragged about being the leader of these rights in Iran. You know, as you can see, there has been a competition for leadership of these deadly rights, from a former footballer to this lady. When it comes to this lady or other people who are involved in this regime change agenda of Western powers, I don't see any difference between them and those MKO terrorists who have blood of thousands of Iranians on their hands. There are many other Iranian expats who were in this delegation. Some of them were in this delegation who met Macron. They have been used by American spy agencies for years. And many of them happen to be working for the prestigious U.S.-based think tanks. So it's natural that Iran will react strongly to Macron's meeting with these troublemongering Western agents.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Master Shajar, Islamic Human Rights Commission, and Sayed Zafar Mehdi, journalist who joined us from Tehran. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Another U.S. citizen has been arrested in Saudi Arabia after getting into a dispute with security officials while performing the pilgrimage. Mohammed Salim, an American of Yemeni origin, was taken into custody in Mecca on November the 1st for making remarks critical of the monarchy. The 63-year-old has been transferred to a maximum security facility typically used for high-profile political prisoners and suspected terrorists. There is no information whether the man has been charged. Last month, another U.S. citizen of Saudi origin was sentenced to 16 years in prison. That apparently because of his Twitter posts on topics including the war on Yemen and the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bahrainis have voted in parliamentary elections, and this may sound like a very positive development, but nothing could be further from the truth. For how could there be a free and fair election when all the opposition groups have been disbanded or crushed? Since 2011, the Bahraini uprising began and has not stopped till this day.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added, holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This, in essence, would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announced that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. And this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's Fifth Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018.
The Bahraini regime's suppression of its Shia citizens and stripping them of their rights, in addition to the jailing and torturing of the opposition members, forced the regime to make a major decision. In October of this year, it withdrew from the Human Rights Council, which was one more nail in the coffin of its commitment to protecting human rights. Government critics saw that as a sign that since it was no longer a member, it would feel free to continue with its crackdown.
The powerful Shia cleric Shariza Qassam has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials,
based solely or primarily on confessions, allegedly coerced through torture and ill treatment. The governments of the U.S. and the U.K., as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the U.S. and the U.K. even have a hand in the deadly protests, like to the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked them to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
Turning elsewhere now, tens of thousands of Mexicans have taken to the streets of the capital, Mexico City, to protest a presidential plan to overhaul the country's electoral commission. The demonstrators fear that Andrés Manuel López Obrador's scheme would concentrate power in the hands of the government. López Obrador, who put the plan forward in April, has long criticized the country's electoral authorities. He accused them of helping to engineer his defeats when he ran for president in 2006 and 2012. He says the reform would let citizens elect electoral authorities and reduce the influence of economic interests in politics. There are concerns that the plan would bring about a power grab because it gives the president more control over the electoral systems. And that brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
More than 7 years have passed since the Saudi aggression against Yemen, and the only achievement of the aggressor from this crime is the killing and displacement of millions of innocent people in the shadow of the silence of the United Nations and human rights institutions. Both the United States and Britain have played a malicious role in thwarting peace efforts in Yemen. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television network has more for us on this story. Yemen's popular resistance movement Ansar Allah warns about the United States and Britain's fresh malicious intentions in the war-ravaged country. Referring to Yemen's biggest province, which spans from the country's center towards its eastern areas, Ali Al-Qahoum, a member of Ansar Allah's political bureau, said, "There is a direct U.S. military presence in Yemen and an influx of U.S. forces, specifically in Hadhramaut province." Referring to Yemen's second largest province that neighbors Hadhramaut to the east, he added, "There is also an influx of British forces into Al-Mahra." The United States and Britain were preparing for a fresh round of escalation in Yemen, he further warned without elaborating. "The Western countries have been contributing heavily and unabatedly to a war of aggression that the Saudi Arabia-led coalition has been waging against Yemen since 2015. The coalition has been seeking unsuccessfully, though, to restore Yemen's power to the country's former Western and Riyadh-aligned officials. The war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis." Washington and London have been providing the coalition with direct arms, logistical and political support, including through outfitting it with precision-guided ammunition that the Saudi-led military forces have been using against the civilian population of Yemen. Al-Qahoum said, "New US and British military delegations had arrived in Yemen recently. Reporting on Wednesday 2nd of November, Yemeni media cited informed local sources as saying that Hadhramaut provincial governor Mahbud bin Mahdi had held a face-to-face meeting with the US delegation in his office. However, the Ansar Allah official asserted that despite the Western states' apparent preparations for a new flare-up in Yemen, the Yemenis are ready to defend their dignity and every inch of their country. Yemen's press agency has more for us on this story. Amid Washington's aggressive attempts to wrest control over energy reserves and plunder natural resources in conflict-plagued Yemen, a new batch of U.S. military forces has entered the country's oil-rich eastern province of Hadhramaut. Citing informed local sources who asked not to be named, the agency reported that Hadhramaut provincial governor Mahbud bin Mahdi had had a face-to-face meeting with a U.S. delegation in his office. During the meeting, Mahbud bin Mahdi complained to the American military officials about the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government's decision to ban the Saudi-led coalition from exporting the Yemeni crude oil, asserting that the decision would have adverse effects on the global energy market. The development comes as visits by Western officials to eastern Yemen has lately witnessed an accelerating trend, the most recent of which was the visit of French ambassador to Aden, Jean-Marie Safa, in late September. The visits are viewed as Western effort to secure its energy needs against the backdrop of the Russian special operation in Ukraine. Back on 28th of July, a batch of U.S. military forces landed at Al-Qaeda Airport in Yemen's southeastern province of Al-Mahra on board a flight from Riyadh International Airport in Mukalla, which lies on the shores of the Arabian Sea and about 480 kilometers east of Aden. The Yemen press agency reported at the time that the arrival of the U.S. forces was followed by a major disruption to internet connectivity in the Seyhout district, blaming the internet blackout on the installation of sophisticated surveillance devices by American military forces. Earlier, a top-ranking Yemeni official said U.S. and British military trainers had arrived at a port in Mahra province on vessels loaded with munitions as well as military and logistical equipment. The provincial governor, Al-Qatabi Ali Hussein Al-Faraj, said on 26th of June that large arms shipments about military vessels disembarked at the port of Nishtun and that British and American military trainers were stationed at Al-Qaeda International Airport. Faraj said at the time, the Saudi-led coalition of aggression is involved in the smuggling and trade of narcotics in the area in order to perpetuate insecurity, to advance its goals and deter the local population from confronting the invaders. Yemen's official Sabah news agency has more for us. The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council has hit out at U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, for scuttling efforts to extend the United Nations brokered truce, describing the truce situation in the country as a time bomb. Mahdi al-Mashat said in Sana'a on Monday, 7th of November, "We are in a no-peace, no-war state. While we had reached a good level of understanding during previous rounds of talks, the American envoy's trip to the region thwarted these efforts." Referring to Lenderking's journey to the region starting on 11th of October to purportedly support the United Nations-led negotiations to extend truce in Yemen, al-Mashat said, "While the U.S. envoy pretends to be a peace dove, he's rather an ill-omened owl." Mahdi al-Mashat said, "Some aggressor countries which benefit from the war in Yemen are pushing the country towards a political and military explosion," citing the U.S. envoy's malicious role in the failure of the peace talks. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war in Yemen back in March of 2015 in collaboration with its Arab allies. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abdurrabb Mansour Hadi and crushed the popular Ansarullah resistance movement of Yemen, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Sana'a. But the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives. The United Nations brokered truce between the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen first came into effect back in April and has been extended twice since then. In mid-October, Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf said there would be no talks about the extension of the six-month truce, which expired on 2nd of October, unless the nation's legitimate demands were fully met. He stressed that the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government will make every effort to establish just and dignified peace throughout the country.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, this is IRIB English Radio, Real Poems Program, and I'm Bita at your service. Today I have the honor to be the host of today's episode. With me I have two dear guests, Brother Ali and Brother Amit. Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
Welcome back to our episode. So today we're going to talk about a special sign of unity in our religion. As you know, there are many actions in our religion, Islam, that show the unity, the alliance of people and the hearts of people together. And we have to actually improve these actions to show to the world that we are here for the same guidelines. We are here to show you the right way to leave. And today, the main point and the main topic is the prayers of Friday or Namaz Jum'ah here, as you know. I want to ask you, what is the reason that I think the effect of this kind of way of worship is lighter and is somehow more ignorant in this society, in this actually new age?
When the Britishers colonized India, one of the British officers, one of the military men, they were walking through one of the streets in an Islamic area, in a Muslim area, and he had a Muslim advisor next to him permanently to kind of, you know, advise him on the local affairs. He heard this sound of adhan, not once, but multiple times in the day, and he was worried. He asked him, "What is this sound of adhan? What is this?" He didn't know adhan, but he said, "What is this?" He said, "Oh, it's what the Muslims do before they pray. They call, they use the microphones to call the people to come to in a congregation to pray to God." And then he asked one very strategic question from this Muslim advisor. He says, "Does this prayer affect our government?" He says, "No." He said, "Instead of five, let them call 10 times a day." Right? The prayer and that Hajj, that Friday prayer, that does not bring opposition from the Taghut, from the pharaohs of the time, then that really doesn't have much effect on the Muslim Ummah or the unity of the Muslim Ummah, principally speaking.
I know.
So all in all, just in one sentence, all the, what is the purpose and what is the philosophy beyond all this congregation is unification of the Islamic Ummah, to enlighten Muslims with the affairs and the environment that they are in, the days that they are living in, and to know what to do, what strategies to take, and how to present themselves in front of their enemies, and how to establish and or prepare how to prepare the whole world for the establishment of that just government to come.
Yeah. Thank you, Brother Ali and Amit, first for your beautiful description of this actually valuable worship in our religion. But the thing is, you've counted many things about a spiritual atmosphere that you will get when you go there, when you go Hajj, when you go to Friday prayers. And also the, you know, the social aspect of this behavior, of this worship, that you will show to the world as Muslims that you are united, you are actually connected together as a actually holy force here. But the thing is, as you know, there is a kind of political part of this action, you know. And for example, there's a question here, for example, in other countries, why should even a Muslim person go to, for example, Friday prayer to listen to another political matters and issues of, you know, another country? For example, a person actually Muslim in another country, a foreign country, go to the Friday prayers to listen to the problems of a country that he left, she left. So what? What is the reason? What should be the reason? You know what?
You want to answer?
Yeah, sure,
it's your turn, but it has a very good answer, I think.
Yeah, I think that good answer could be safeguarded by yourself. I'm just going to give you the bad answer for now.
Yeah.
You see, I'm going to go from a different perspective, not from the perspective I'm sure that he's not going to use, just so that I'm going to leave the good answer once again to himself.
Okay.
You see, first of all, when we look at the Quran itself, we see that it is hudan linnas. It is a guidance to mankind. And when a commandment comes in the noble Quran, we are certain that it is for all times and it is for all people. Not specific to a specific place. There are places in the noble Quran where the Quran itself specified, for example, Ya ayyuhal mu'minun, Ya ayyuhal nas, Ya ayyuhal, for example, Ya ahl al-kitab. The audience is specific time, Laylatul Qadr, specific place, Hajj, right? But there are certain things that are very open. For example, this the verse of the noble Quran recited for the Friday prayer, the Jummah prayer, It wasn't specific to any location. It was specific to people. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, right? Those who believe, for Muslims, right? In addition to that, so when we can conclude that this Jummah prayer, when it comes to from an Islamic point of view, it's not specific to an Islamic government, it's for all.
Yeah.
Wherever the Muslims are, they should try to come, get themselves united, right, and have a congregation. Not necessarily, they can speak of, you know, it's good that they speak of the affairs faced by the community, the Muslim community where they're living in, right? In addition to that, they can also speak politically wherever they have that position and that capability and capacity, right? Because yeah. I know at least in some of these countries, we have Muslim representatives in the parliament. They have an effect in the legislation and the execution of the government of that country. So if, for example, in India, at least I can tell you, Muslims can come together, speak about the political issues that are that the Muslims are facing right in India itself, though it's not an Islamic government. But it's a government. But it's a country where many Muslims are living.
Mm-hmm.
The unification of Muslims in that country is more objective. It's more important than maybe some, you know, Islamic country. Why? Yeah. Because in those countries, Muslims are more prone to aggression. They're more prone to, you know, difficulties that we may not be facing. Yes, we do have difficulties in the Islamic countries. That's on their, that's in its own time and place. But in the non-Muslim countries, They still have the difficulties that they face, specific difficulties. That can be solved in the Salatul Jama'ah. One other question. So the question I'd like to ask Mr. Ali over here is that you were talking about how the strengthening of, you know, brotherhood and, you know, being informed of the political and the Muslim affairs. Isn't that, you know, quite easy for us in this day and age that we have these devices, these mainstream media, not we going to the media coming to us. Every single, you know, second we have notifications on our phones about the news of the world. We even know things before time. Even before the time the Friday comes, we know the news, what's going on right now at this moment, just by a click of a search.
Yeah, that's a good question as well, because I want to start from the first question, inshallah, slowly we'll move to the other question. I want to tell you that I totally disagree with you. Sorry, totally agree with you, sister.
Yeah.
Out of surprise, you might say. I totally agree with you that, yeah, we are not obliged to go to another country and sit and listen to the khutbahs or sermons of another imam who is not talking about the issues of our country.
Who is that person who is going to...
And that's why we say that, yes, the hajj, the Muhammadan hajj that the Holy Prophet actually prescribed and legislated is not being practiced today. At the time that the Prophet was doing the hajj in the khutbahs of there, actually he was solving the issues of different Muslims from different parts of the country. From different parts of the world. So, look, in case we find different issues and problems in the Islamic Ummah, like Afghanistan, Pakistan, let's say Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Palestine. You see, we see lots of problems from different extremist groups. So where is the best place to talk about their issues? There. Usually in Islam, the khutbahs or the Friday prayer before people move to Arafat, that is some days before Hajj starts, is the most important khutbah or let's say sermons of the year. That's why it has to be done in a professional matter. But how is it being done now? It's just something, as
it's
you
like
said, a local. It's something quite, let's say, ridiculous and local.
Yeah.
And no, you will never, ever hear about the problems of Muslims in different parts of the world. You see, you just hear some, let's say, trivial issues on what, for example, happened in Saudi Arabia. We are not actually criticizing the language. No, the language can be Arabic because Muslims, majority of Islamic Ummah know Arabic, or at least understand Arabic. So it can be in Arabic because this is the common language that we can establish and put between ourselves. But what should be said there? This is not what the Holy Prophet did. This is not the Sunnah of the Prophet. To be indifferent towards all the issues of the Islamic Ummah, just to pray for the health of the king of that area. No, brother, they have actually mistaken the purpose of this great gathering and congregation. So the best place to talk about the problems, the affairs of the Islamic Ummah is Hajj.
Yeah.
And it has been ignored. So we cannot find such issues to be resolved there. But the problem, as for your question that you said, while we have access to social media, isn't enough to sit somewhere and work on that. It's as if to say, okay, when I can perform my morning prayer while, in a robotic manner, so why should I perform it? When something is compulsory on you, obligatory on you, we have to perform it. Hajj is not something that optional for us. In case we have the capacity and the ability to go for Hajj, so it is on our shoulder to go. So we cannot. So we can put it aside and then we can act through, cyberspace. No, it has to happen in that land. You see, this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala prescribed it, not only for us, not only for Muslims, even for religions before us, even for Ibrahim, even for Moses, even for other prophets. If you study about the story of this bait, this house of God, you see that it was sacred not only for Muslims, even for the religions before us. So it has to happen there. And the Muslims come and congregate and collect there and do their actions and rituals there. And a part of the rituals are, political requests and, economic and different issues and affairs that Muslims have in Islamic Ummah.
You mentioned robotic, and it recalled me of a story, of a movie rather. There is this movie called WALL-E, I'm not sure if you've seen it, where the people are kind of sitting on the beds and they're just, just speaking through a virtual platform and their robots are taking care of them. And at the end, when the robot essentially victoriously liberates the people from this virtual life, they understand how it feels to be really touched by one another. And I think it's very important that when we talk about the Friday prayer in the congregations, yes, we do understand, we do have news and we do have, many of these media coming together, but this virtual world is always different from the physical world. I had this brother who was consistently telling me about this, sister who is about to get married and stuff. And I was like, have you ever met her? Like, no, it was from Facebook. And then I was like, why don't you meet? You're getting married. Let's see each other. And then he got his permission from his parents and the sister got permission and so on. When they eventually met, he couldn't say a word in front of that sister, nor did the sister in front of the brother. Why? Because this virtual world, though you get the information, the data in your brain, but then the execution from the body itself, that power of being unified, like in the Friday prayer, is different.
Okay. One last point. Do we have time?
Yeah. No, not that much, actually.
One short one. Okay.
One
last point. I just wanted to let you know that I remember one of the Friday prayers before Hajj starts. I was there and was listening to the Imam. Surprisingly, he was talking about how to shake hands and the etiquettes of shaking hands with another Muslim brother. And where almost 2 million, pilgrims were sitting there to perform. So do you think this is the matter about in Islamic Ummah, the issue that we are facing with?
Yeah.
So don't we have any people who are massacred, for example, in Palestine, in Yemen, in other Muslim countries? Is it the only issue that we are actually stuck in? This is a sort of, as you rightly mentioned, we have to talk about the issues of the Islamic Ummah there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear brothers. And at first, I had the same thought as my dear brother and me that, there are many ways to show our unity to the world, for example, social media and whatever. But that physical atmosphere that you will experience in that sort of places are something that you cannot replace by any virtual world, I think. And, this conversation just made me to go through a Friday prayers afterwards. And I want to experience it actually, from the bottom of my heart.
I can give you a joke on this as well. A person asked... The person asked an alim and he says, how come, is it possible for me to have a congregational prayer through the TV? The TV is relaying the prayer. I can just, join the prayer with the imam. So the alim says, why not? You can also put a cloth on your fridge and have Hajj right in your home. It's as simple as that. It's so convenient. Yeah.
That was a nice one. So that was the all the time we have for today's discussion. I wish you, dear listeners, enjoyed our topic of today. Thank you for being with us. And farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Allah. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new analysis shows that there were more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the climate talks in Egypt than representatives of the 10 nations most affected by the crisis. This issue has raised concerns about the ineffectiveness of these talks. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote, the COP27 talks in Egypt was billed as an opportunity for countries to showcase unity against the existential threat of climate change, but an analysis released recently shows there are more fossil fuel lobbyists attending the conference than representatives of the 10 nations most affected by the crisis, heightening concerns that industry influence will water down any agreements reached at the event. A data analysis of the United Nations provisional attendance list for the closely watched conference shows that 636 fossil fuel lobbyists have been registered at the talks, up 25% from last year's COP26 conference in Glasgow. According to Corporate Accountability, Corporate Europe Observatory, and Global Witness, the groups that conducted the analysis, there are more fossil fuel lobbyists registered at COP27 than any single national delegation. While officials from the conference's host country of Egypt have characterized the talks as African COP, pledging to center the developing world in negotiations over climate solutions, fossil fuel lobbyists outnumber any national delegation from Africa, where oil and gas giants are aggressively pursuing new fossil fuel development, even as climate-driven extreme weather ravages the continent. Additionally, the new analysis shows there are more fossil fuel lobbyists at COP27 than officials from Puerto Rico, Myanmar, Haiti, the Philippines, Mozambique, the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Thailand, and Nepal, which the German Watch Global Climate Risk Index deems the 10 countries most impacted by the worsening global climate emergency. With time running out to avert climate disaster, major talks like COP27 absolutely must advance concrete action to stop the toxic practices of the fossil fuel industry that is causing more damage to the climate than any other industry, said a spokesperson for the three watchdog organizations, adding, the extraordinary presence of this industry's lobbyists at these talks is therefore a twisted joke at the expense of both people and planet. A list published by Corporate Accountability Corporate Europe Observatory and Global Witness shows that corporations and trade groups attending COP27 include the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a powerful lobbying organization that has been dubbed the Chamber of Carbon, as well as Exxon, Chevron, and other major oil and gas firms. The U.S.-based public relations firm that the Egyptian government hired to run communications for COP27 has close ties to the fossil fuel industry with a client list that includes Exxon. The outsized presence of the industry most responsible for the climate crisis has outraged climate campaigners who are vocally protesting polluters' influence on the COP27 talks as they continue to produce woefully insufficient action plans. The climate crisis is upon us, yet world governments continue to protect the interests of a few greedy corporations instead of the people who are most affected, said Kick Polluters Out campaign, which is holding a protest on the ground in Sharm el-Sheikh. Nowhere is that more clear than at the COP27, where big polluters like fossil fuel lobbyists have once again converged to greenwash their polluting image and block the climate action we so desperately need, he said. Corporate Accountability, Corporate Europe Observatory, and Global Witness noted that, unlike fossil fuel lobbyists, activists from the Global South and others harmed disproportionately by the climate crisis have effectively been shut out of the talks by high cost, visa challenges, and repressive actions by the hosting country. Rather than being the start of the real climate action needed, COP27 looks set to be a festival of fossil fuels and their polluting friends, buoyed by recent bumper profits, spokesperson for the coalition said, adding, the tobacco lobbyists wouldn't be welcome at health conferences. Arms dealers can't promote their trade at peace conventions. The spokesperson added, those perpetuating the world's fossil fuel addiction should not be allowed through the doors of a climate conference. It's time governments got out of the pockets of polluters, come to their senses, and help make COP27 the success the world vitally needs it to be. Meanwhile, Common Dreams Road campaigners pushed back recently after U.S. President Joe Biden touted his administration's bold agenda to tackle the climate emergency during a speech at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Egypt. Addressing COP27 attendees at Tonino Lamborghini International Convention Center Sharm el-Sheikh, Biden asserted that his administration is meeting the climate crisis with urgency and determination in service of a cleaner, healthier, and safer planet for us all. As Common Dreams reported earlier, green groups welcomed Biden's announcement of stronger regulations meant to curb methane pollution resulting from oil and gas production. However, activists stressed that the president must do substantially more to combat the planetary emergency. If President Biden is serious that the U.S. is doing its part to avert climate hell, he would deliver a plan to end the era of fossil fuels. Greenpeace USA Chief Program Officer Tefer Geber said in a statement, the Biden administration has failed to deliver on their commitment to phase out oil and gas lease sales on public lands and water, and instead continues to sacrifice the health and safety of frontline communities. The commitments made today are a band-aid on damage that threatens our collective future. Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon said, "We applaud the Biden administration's commitment to clean energy investments. The Biden administration must act to catalyze climate solutions and aggressively rein in fossil pollution. The roadmap to emission reduction is clear. We must end fossil fuel extraction and exports, ensure frontline communities, which already bear the brunt of toxic pollution and extreme weather, are prioritized for investments, and strengthen and protect our bedrock environmental laws that will be crucial to building clean energy future." Rachel Kleitas, Policy Director and Lead Economist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, asserted that Biden's COP27 speech comes at a time when the urgency of climate crisis is clear, but so is the significant shortfall in actions to address it globally, especially from richer countries like the United States. "The opportunity is there for the U.S. to finally live up to its responsibilities on the global stage, and the time is now," Kleitas said, adding that with the latest science showing that the global emissions trajectory is far off track, and with devastating and costly climate impacts already taking a harsh toll on people in the U.S. and around the world, the U.S. must take bolder action to cut its emissions together with other major emitting nations and increase investment in climate resilience.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.